What a long, strange ride it's been, and no end in sight. The only part of it that's history is Ted Stevens and the corruption trials of state legislators. Sarah Palin, Joe Miller, maybe. But even if it's over, do we have the whole story on any of it? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. History on the Run is the subject today. Call 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org to talk with the authors of Crude Awakening on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, let's see. We could probably go for the next couple of months here doing only new books about Alaska issues. We probably could. We probably won't. But we want to get this one in, Crude Awakening, Money, Mavericks, and Mayhem in Alaska by Amanda Coyne and Tony Hopfinger. I've known both of them since they came to the state. They're the founders of Alaska Dispatch, and it's a great pleasure to welcome them both to Talk of Alaska. Hi, Amanda.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having us.
Tony.
Thank you.
So you guys are, pretend you're not bloggers. Tell me about that.
In what sense?
Well, Alaska Dispatch, I believe, never gets printed anywhere unless I choose to print it at home.
Right, right. We're online only. You can find blogs there, and you can find news, but it's your virtual newspaper, essentially.
So it's beyond weblog, in other words. It's just not Tony in his pajamas.
It was for a while.
You're not supposed to admit that.
But now we have a full staff of really experienced journalists who've worked in Alaska for many, many years.
We started the Dispatch actually out of our spare bedroom, and so of which we have one.
So the pajama.
So it's not like we have a palatial house.
The
or anything.
Pajama incident may have occurred.
Yeah, probably more than
more than one occasion.
Yeah.
Well, there it is. Sometimes radio can be a little sketchy, but nowadays we got radio on TV.
Oh.
So we got to be a little careful about it. Oh, yes. It says right here, remind all guests, please turn all cell phones off. Okay. Crude Awakening, Money, Mavericks, and Mayhem in Alaska. Tricky little bit there, especially the Mavericks and Mayhem.
Yeah, that was our agent actually came up with that one.
I kept waiting for the Mayhem.
Well, there's some mayhem.
But by Alaska standards, come on.
Well, there's some
That's
mayhem.
Right, yeah, by
the
Alaska.
The real mayhem is like, you know, Wally Hickel bulldozing a road to the North Slope.
I have that in there.
Yeah, I know. Some of the Joe Vogler stunts, you know, that's mayhem.
Yeah, yeah. We even have Vogler in there.
You do indeed. And I guess that was kind of the idea, because I know some of the genesis of this book. I mean, I know, Amanda, you started wanting to write a Sarah Palin book.
Long ago. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you were among the first in the journalistic community to say, you know, something extraordinary socially is going on here, and wanting to get a hold of.
Yeah, and then when I got a little bit more of a hold of it than I thought I would, I didn't want it anymore.
So yeah, right.
That was kind of the story with that.
Not
one.
Quite a book.
Yeah. Well, you know, Kent Sturgis, bless his heart, from Epicenter Press, who I just want to give a shout out because he's done a great Alaska books, but he contacted me to do just kind of a little bio on Sarah, and Sarah takes on big oil story kind of thing. And I thought that was going to be interesting. That was right when she was pretty much first in office, and I thought that would be an interesting project. Then I started researching it, and I don't know. I've tried to figure out why it was, but my gut just was telling me no. The more I kind of looked into it, the more I just kind of said no.
I think part of it was that there were so many things that were still uncertain, right? The pendulum.
Boy, were there!
Right. Yeah. The pendulum swung after Murkowski and with the emerging corruption investigation. And Sarah set out to do some major policy shifts, and it was too early to tell for a book what those policy shifts were going to mean, whether that was going to make her one of the best governors ever or if she was going to flame out. And so I think at that point, Amanda was like, we just got to wait and see. It's too early to write a book. And really, you were contacted right after she was elected.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So it was I think a little premature. So what ended up happening is then we...
It was big Alaska history thing that had happened, you know, because we'd had Arliss and Fran before that running and not succeeding, and all of a sudden this woman from Wasilla becomes the governor.
No, it was pretty
and incredible. And that was essentially, I think, the book that Kent was looking for was one about the first female governor. But
yeah,
we were interested in how the policies were going to play out. What would make of her of substance then? And as 07 unfolded, and you know, you were there with us covering the trials and whatnot, suddenly there's this whole other narrative, and you start seeing things as the course of history and how it propelled Sarah, and you know, the conflict with oil that was emerging in the courtroom, all that. So suddenly there was another book to be read.
Yeah, bigger, yeah. Much bigger book than that.
You know, anyway. It is interesting, and it's been said before, but basically you drain oil out of the story of Alaska's history, and most of Alaska's history disappears.
No.
Yeah, except for 9 years, basically, in state history, yeah.
Yeah, and it's true. It was so pervasive in so many different ways. And so I think that's the realization you guys must have come to as you were working on this book. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that, about how it keeps coming back to oil, whether it's Bill Allen or Ted Stevens or Sarah Palin and Randy Riedrich. You know, oil is always there someplace.
I think the most interesting thing for Amanda and I, and she did a lot more reporting on this than I did, but the oil tax fight, right? It started right away. As soon as the oil was discovered, and it was on state land, which made it somewhat unusual in Texas and North Dakota. There's a lot of private land.
Yeah, you guys, you know, I was only here for part of it, but I was here for more of it than you. And you guys really had to sketch over, like, the whole business with the ad hocs and all that, you know, which, of course, would have vastly expanded your book. And you obviously were up against that over and over again. He says, well, Jesus, you know, how much can I really put in here?
Yeah,
I think it's real simple. I mean, it's the same fight that, you know, at the debate yesterday with Guerra and the WDNR commissioner. It's the same thing that's been going on for 40 years. It's a fight over how much is the quote-unquote fair share. How much should the state tax the oil companies? And how's that influence development? And when you have that much money on the table, billions and billions of dollars, there's always going to be some kind of conflict, some kind of corruption that's going to develop, I think.
Well, it's an unanswerable question. But I think lots of times...
It's a game of chicken.
Well, exactly. I think sometimes it just becomes a political game. In other words, the investment in literally buying a majority of our politicians is way less.
As are the APOC fines get nailed.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. And that happened to Bill Allen. I was here when it happened to him the first time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, you know, the thing that I moved up here in 2001 and you know, oil was just, it was just a given, right? It wasn't anything that, you know, I just assumed that that's kind of just the way that Alaska was. And doing the research and looking back at what was Alaska before oil and then seeing the slow, kind of really reading that slow, steady march towards having it just consume all of the state's energy and all of the state's basically time and energy. And it, except for a brief moment in the 1990s when oil was, you know, $9, $15 a barrel, had gotten down pretty low when people weren't talking about the tax structure so much. That was
then it was about whether we should tax ourselves.
Yeah, that kind of consumed our state, and it has since, and it seems to me that's not going to stop anytime soon. So the tax over oil, or the fight over oil taxes, is just it's a groundhog day every day, and almost the same language. You know, the same. I looked at the 1968 legislative hearings about when they were trying to figure out the tax structure then, and the same language you could just cut and paste and put it in, you know, into this last session, and it would sound like almost exactly the same.
Yeah, it's hard to, in a public affairs sense, in a journalistic sense, you know, it's hard to know where to advance this thing beyond.
Mm-hmm.
He said, she said, because, you know, that tends to be the kind of reporting we do. Well, you know, this Democrat says here, and this oil-allied Republican says there, and And we let it go at that.
Well, part of that is just we're at the mercy of industry giving us numbers, our state numbers, and it's just sort of in the eye of the beholder what you include in those numbers, what you don't include. I absolutely agree. It's one of the most frustrating things as a reporter up here is not to be able to tell Alaskans exactly where the truth lies with our taxes and how they compare to other provinces and whatnot around the world.
Well, I want to get to tales of the book here, but I do want to probe this little oil industry business a little bit more, Tony, because you've had a certain fascination with and had sources knowledgeable about the industry. And I think there was a certain point where you thought maybe you had a book, you know, which kind of came when, you know, you started getting sources about Bill Allen.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really kind of occurred to me back when Peacock was on trial. It started to seem real cinematic in my head of the narrative that's going on here.
Well, it is, and you did get it in the book.
Well, you remember that incident where there were allegations that Bill Allen was threatening to kill his nephew, and you started to see sort of this almost like a Tony Soprano kind of figure. We knew a lot about Bill Allen, but not all those things. And so the idea, I mean, people don't want to just read about tax policy, and this book's not just about tax policy. We'll certainly give you a bunch in the book about that, but it's about characters, and there's a whole assortment of characters that go beyond Bill Allen, Ted Stevens, and Sarah Palin in this book. And that's, I guess, from a storytelling perspective, that's what got me interested in the idea of trying to craft something that sort of combined what Amanda had been working on with Sarah Palin and what I've been working on with Bill Allen.
And I, you know, not to belabor it, but I think your source, Anderson, said at some point, I mean, he just doesn't want to talk about it anymore. He's just rid of it. He's out of here and calls a bunch of hillbilly stuff, right?
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, it was, he's a character in of himself. And here's a guy who's an oil welder, and he's working on the senator's home. He's delivering, you know, money to politicians. He's doing all sorts of things, partaking in sort of this bigger, massive narrative that's unfolding in the state. Again, the fight over of taxes, oil taxes. In the case of Stevens, of course, that was for, you know, possibly for, I guess, influence in the Appropriations Committee.
Well, yeah. But your fascination then is like with these sources. I mean, you also you and I both like to talk to Chuck Hamill.
Yes,
you know, and Chuck Hamill is the guy that basically he was done dirty years ago on an oil pipeline deal, and he's been upset about it ever since. He's been after the oil industry. People would often disregard what he said or said, you know, he's a pest, he's a gadfly, he's not credible. But actually, he was always credible.
Chuck Hamill probably cost Alyeska somewhere around the neighborhood of $750 million in maintenance to that pipeline. And you could, you know, you have these various sources that have conflicts of interest, whether it's Chuck or Dave Anderson or others, right? But us as journalists, we talk to these people because they're right sometimes. And it's fun, you know, some of the things that they say to try to track down the truth there and see where it lies. And that was part of the fun part with some of the characters that surrounded Bill Allen.
So here you end up with a teenage prostitute. And she's got she's out for money. You know, I don't even know what to do with that in a court of law.
Well, yeah. There's a few of them.
Yeah.
We're talking about the alleged prostitutes or underage girls that Bill Allen allegedly had sex with or had sexual relationships with. Yeah, I mean, you can't make this stuff up, and it adds a whole nother narrative of raising questions of whether Bill Allen was cooperating with the federal government because he did not want those things out. Of course, they did come out. The media really dogged that story as they started hearing things about it, but now you have this other element. Is the Justice Department covering up something?
And, yeah.
You know, so
the story's not over. And in a sense, you know, you probably need to end this book in another week or two when the Justice Department probe is out because
yeah,
it's still not
but
out.
But we don't even know if that's going to be public, number one. And, you know, but number two, like, you know, we were caught in the middle of this story. And there is something about narrative urgency that I kind of wanted to pick up on, too. And, you know, we could have written this 5-10 years later. And I'm not sure that it would have had or at least for me, the emotional kind of impact as far as writing it, kind of went. So,
well, were you Amanda, the one that would stick the Alaska color in from time to say, and Alaskans came back home and the weather got nice, and all of a sudden all the natural beauty. It's actually very, very touching the way you.
Thank you. Yeah, and Tony helped with some of that too. I mean, we both worked on that.
Uh huh. Well, it's an interesting device because it's a little bit over the top. In other words, you say, okay, let's have a rest from all this sordid.
Yeah.
You can still look at the glaciers and the mounds, and you know those things haven't changed.
I did want to give the readers though a good feeling of what it felt like up here, just as importantly. I think that in some ways that's just as important as anything. Like what, you know, what's at stake for this state? You know, the beauty and the magnificence, and you know, the sense of community. And what was actually kind of more at stake? I mean, it could have given them a whole just primer on oil taxes and corruption, and that really wasn't going to be satisfying enough for me as a writer, at least.
Well, yeah, I mean, the quick assumption is, well, Alaskans are just oil sluts. I mean, they get checks from oil. They'll do anything for oil, and it's not that simple. An example, for instance, is. You need to explain in this book why quitting being governor of Alaska is such an egregious thing to Alaskans.
Because
nobody could understand why, nobody from outside Alaska could understand why her approval rating dropped in the state the minute that happened.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you have a governor who has decided to take the state on a new course with oil policy. The ACEs tax plan and AGEA natural gas pipeline plan, both those were really bucking the trend, right?
Huge.
And the pendulum has swung. And no matter where you stand on your belief of those policies, whether you're for them or against them, she had taken that on, and she had taken our state on that course. To just quit the job in the middle of it, I mean, how can he not be upset with that? I mean, even if you disagree with those policies, finish what you started.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of many people that are not in your book here, John Bitney. I'm here. Yes, I noticed. I saw that right away. I appreciate that. John Bitney, who was a close aide of Palin's in the beginning and, you know, later, as he said, thrown under the bus, He has described, you know, with great passion, the strength of the mandate that she came to office with.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you could do anything.
Yeah.
And then he would tell her that. You can do anything. You can accomplish anything. And he felt that as time went on, there was an erosion of attention and focus and whatnot, and she threw it all away.
Yeah, I mean, whether she's opportunistic and she was had her eyes on the White House or whatnot, I don't know. But I think that's exactly right what John said.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was a pretty incredible time.
We're talking to Amanda Coyne, Tony Huffinger, authors of Crude Awakening, Money, Mavericks, and Mayhem in Alaska. We've done a little bit of money, a little mayhem, and I guess we've done a little bit of Mavericks. I think it's time to let the callers have a shot. Good morning. You're on Talk of Alaska. Oh. Okay. False alarm.
Oh.
I thought the phone calls weren't showing up on the prompt here. Telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. So let me ask you this. Are there any smoking guns in this book, would you say? Tony?
I mean, I think we have some reporting in there about where the FBI was coming from in their investigation. One of the things that we had not reported at the time but that we included in the book was a conversation with one of the special agents who was leading the Polar Pen investigation. And several months before they indicted Ted Stevens, I was talking to her, and she asked me, what do you think the quid pro quo was with the remodel of Ted Stevens' house? In which I responded, "You guys don't have that yet? You've already searched his house."
was your response?
Yeah.
Well, that pretty well shut down that source.
No, they still talk, but I just found that a little interesting that they obviously thought they had something there.
Well, they had enough that they felt that they had a case.
But they were hoping they had a some kind of bribery case, and then in the end they had the failing to disclose. I think showed how much on the fly they were putting that investigation together. And ultimately, look, the convictions were tossed. Now, that said,
they were probably tossed because of the underage girl stuff that the defense claimed it should have had, don't you think?
I don't know how much that came into play in actually that particular case. I know there were other missteps that the prosecutors had during the trial.
Well, they wanted to use that. I mean, Sullivan wanted to use anything he could to undermine Allen and call him a liar.
That's a good question. He chose not to use it, but I think it was the nuclear bomb option. They could have used it. But then what would that say of Ted Stevens hanging around with Bill Allen?
Well, I was wondering that, jury. Too. So now we got one of those questions that hasn't been answered yet.
But that was one of the reasons why Peacock and Vicorian, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
The sexual allegations.
Those
cases.
Wanted to give them those two. Let's back up for the listener who doesn't really know, all of this. But,
started with Judge Sedgwick. And
they were convicted.
Him deciding not to allow that.
Yeah. And then they
him being a neighbor.
And him presiding over the Joe Boehm case.
Yeah, and some of the agents, the FBI or the prosecutors also that were convicting, that were in charge of this investigation and the convictions were also at least one of them was working on the Boehm case too. So he knew all about the Allen kind of sexual dalliances.
Okay, man, and now I want to hear you put all these pieces together with
sexual dalliances. So Peacock and Vic Corrine, they're charged and they're found guilty of bribery, and they spent a year in prison, and they appealed following the Ted Stevens exoneration, and they appealed, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, the stuff about Bill Allen's his sexual affinity with young alleged sexual affinity for young girls, that should have been part of discovery, right? The defense lawyers should have gotten that information, and the prosecutors knew it. They withheld that from the defense, and so the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
And the judge allowed them to.
And the judge allowed them to in a back room.
He decided it was kind of irrelevant. Cott's lawyer didn't pick up on that.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. He was actually there's a long story behind that one, but. We were trying to get a response during the first couple days of the trial with Cott.
Attorney Jim Wendt here, and we asked him. We at that point we had the basic narrative of what was going on, the individuals' names that were
Bambi Tyree
that allegedly had this relationship with Bill Allen, and we asked Jim Wendt. We said, are you gonna bring this up? And he looked at us like he didn't know what we were talking about. And he said, "You guys are just like National Enquirer reporters or something."
He was so
he
mad
didn't he
at
had
us.
No idea. So when he actually was called before the judge, and Sedgwick knew because he was involved in the Boehm case, Wendt had no way to wow. raise an objection for his client Cott.
Now it's hard to imagine a lawyer in Alaska being so conventional, he got trapped that way.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we got some over-the-top lawyers here.
Well. Cott went on to get another lawyer, and she really dug into it. And we ended up getting a whole bunch of, the media and the public got a whole bunch of documents and investigative reports, FBI 302s, et cetera, that really sort of detailed this long narrative of interactions with some of the same prosecutors who had been involved in the Joseph Boehm case where Bambi Tyree had been involved in crossing over into the Bill Allen case. You have to wonder what exactly was going on and who knew what and when and how that information was used against Bill Allen.
I guess I should explain the background. The Joe Boehm case was absolutely notorious in Alaska. Here's a guy who, and this is not the only time that something like this happened, where somebody got so wealthy in Alaska that they fell prey to cocaine, and the next thing you know, all sorts of other stuff is going on in their houses. And that's kind of what happened with the guy that owned Alaska Industrial Hardware, who ended up essentially being held prisoner, really, by some enterprising young I don't know what to call it. Sex workers or what?
I
called it in the chapter about it. I called it the Lord of the Flies on crack. I mean, they're just.
that's the chapter title for that one.
Yeah, they were just kids who just.
Here's this guy.
Yeah, Millionaire Joe, they call him. And they just got him so stirred. He allowed himself, you know, I mean, he's a 55, 60-year-old man.
Right.
And he certainly allowed himself to just get totally, totally addicted to crack and just kind of went crazy on the stuff.
But his girlfriend, associate Bambi Tyree, a young woman at that time, she's the one who also, apparently years before, had the relationship with Bill Allen.
Right. And there's the tie.
Yeah.
And then she
maybe
went
the
to,
only tie.
Well, Amanda and I, at one point, when we were trying to figure this all out, these connections, and this was in the lead up, just as Cott's trial was starting in September of 2007, we had found out that Bambi Tyree worked at this Mexican restaurant. We went there. As we were pulling up, we saw her getting out of a brand new pickup truck. We asked her about Bill, and she ran away. And we wrote down the license plate. It turned out it was Bill Allen had bought the truck. So then we're like, all right, well, I mean,
we're
this is all looking
something.
A little.
Oh, man. Yeah, yeah. That was pretty heady.
What have I got hold of by the tail here?
Yeah.
Ooh, but then Bill Allen's lawyer called, Bob Bundy called, and said, you know, you guys have it all wrong. And it was mostly
he
Tony.
Said that. Yeah, he said that Bambi was just borrowing the truck to do laundry.
Ah.
That was the...
And then also Bambi did go to Bill Allen's house, knocked on his door after Boehm's house was busted. Like, you know, she was on the run for a little while, and then she went to him and knocked on his door to ask for help. So there was an ongoing relationship there.
I mean, it was a lot of people's Uncle Bill. I'm serious.
Yeah, he was Uncle Bill, and there was Uncle Ted.
No, I'm dead serious.
No, I know.
He has a fairly generous, magnanimous nature.
I said no. I mean, I don't. It's like it was not like he was giving a ton of money out to people. You know, describe his sisters.
Yeah, I went to New Mexico, his Farmington, New Mexico, where he's from, and you know, and looked at his family's houses. They wouldn't talk to me. They didn't. They were kind of.
My sister has a place up there.
Yeah, sister and his mom and everything, and his brother, and you know, and his brother had been. According to court documents, had been declared destitute, you know, a few years earlier. And his sister is living kind of in a rundown, you know, trailer on the side of the town. So it wasn't, I mean, you know, they revered him there. I mean, he paid for his brother's funeral and he paid for things like that. But it wasn't as if they were living particularly well, as from what I could tell, at least from the outside. So he wasn't
it's
like...
It's an eye of the beholder.
Yeah, so it wasn't as if he was just, you know... giving all of his millions of dollars to his extended family.
But that didn't even make the book.
It did.
It did?
Some of that did,
yeah. One,
a little bit, half a paragraph maybe.
Well, there's about a page about the description of New Mexico and then going up to his sister's house and knocking on the door. I mean, you know, Steve, as you know, I mean, this is just a huge, we also were on deadline too, you know, and this was an incredibly huge story. And
so if you had your druthers, how long would this book be?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, like I was telling you before we went on air, there was a chapter that I'd been working on related to Chuck Hamill. We had started dabbling with the North Slope Burl scandal from the late 80s. There was, you know, should we do a whole chapter on Exxon Valdez? I don't know. Should we try to probe the 81, 82 legislature when there was obviously some stuff going on, and that's when we, had rescinded the income tax? How far should we try to track the actual bribing of lawmakers?
Ramona Barnes was an important part of all this.
That's right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, go back to Jan Fanks and some of the things that were kind of interesting. I mean, like we talked to Rick Helford. He had interactions with Bill. One time, Bill tried to tip him $10,000.
Right. See, that's generous and magnanimous.
Yeah.
Of course, it is a influential senator you're trying to bribe. But.
And so, I mean, when you start looking at it that way, I mean, I don't know how far back the actual bribing went on. That's what was interesting to me in a hole in the narrative. I mean, did it go back to the late 80s? Was he doing this with Rick Smith? You know, because Rick came on around 89, I guess, even before then. I don't know. I mean, that was interesting to me to just kind of, I wish we could have nailed that part of it.
Well, yeah, I like that you got detailed descriptions of my two favorite scenes from the Baranoff room. The we gotta produce, Rick. Bunch, which I don't think you listen to and ever forget.
Yes.
And then the other one that everybody always talks about with "I own your ass."
Well, yeah. There was also the Easter egg hunt. I thought that one we had to include that.
Well, that's almost in a category of its own.
Yeah, yeah.
visually is very fascinating. That one. Yeah. Oh my God. We're talking to Tony Hoffinger, Amanda Coyne, authors of Crude Awakening, Money, Mavericks, and Mayhem in Alaska. And can you imagine a person outside of Alaska who doesn't know any of the background of all this trying to make sense of what in the world are they talking about?
Well, that was kind of one of the impetuses for this book, too, is because I remember when Sarah was on the national stage and I heard some, I think it was Slate reporters, they just mentioned that, you know, Alaska politics is as complicated and confusing to them as Iranian politics. You know, it's, you just can't. So, you know, they just didn't even know where to begin. And we saw these, you know, trove of reporters, national reporters coming up here, you know, some of them staying in our house, but coming up here in 2008 to report on Sarah. And they just felt that they just were lost, and they were it was obvious that they were just totally lost in the larger narrative of the state and what actually had happened. And so that was one of the reasons to put that out there
it's
and say, hey, you know, this is our Alaska.
It's kind of like, I mean, the question always that everyone was getting right, how did Sarah become governor? Well, you have to really understand the narrative, you have to step back a ways. And you have
way
to understand how the state's relationship developed with oil. And the various political parties and factions and leaders and whatnot that had happened. I mean, it's not just what happened in 06, and that's why we tried to spend some time going back to, you know, even the Constitutional Convention. And because of all that, that's why some things didn't make it into the book. You know, it's like at a certain point, it becomes too complicated. So we tried to boil it down and focus on the highlights that pertain to these three characters and their interactions over 40 years.
Well, I think that's a core part of the narrative, the Frank Murkowski aspirations, mm-hmm. the disappointment of Alaskans, the Randy Friedrich appointment and what a disaster that was, the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission and the revelations coming out of that was kind of a perfect storm. I think you guys are real good on that part of the book. And we'll talk about more of it when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the Muskox Producers Co-op, whose Alaska Native members hand-knit Kiviut items, located in the little brown house at the corner of 6th and H Street. Alaska Pacific University offers accelerated BA and MBA business degrees with personalized attention for your professional goals, online classes, and small class size, supported by a highly respected faculty. A degree from APU is your best value in the business community. Start or finish your business degree at Alaska Pacific University. Enroll now for the spring semester. Learn more at business.alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by the Alaska Pacific University Business Department.
Crude Awakening, Money, Mavericks, and Mayhem in Alaska. What in the world could this book be about? Oh, yes, and it looks like the cover has actually been oiled here. It's like somebody spattered a little bit of crude on this thing here.
They did a good job of that cover.
Published by Nation Books, a member of the Perseus Books Group. Amanda Coyne and Tony Hoffinger wrote it, and they're making their press tour. They're all over the place. You guys it just started, right, a few days ago?
Yeah. Well, we were in D.C. last week, and then Seattle, and then now it's back home.
Back here.
Yeah, and so we've got book signing in Palmer next weekend. We've got Barnes & Noble, I think, on December 2nd. We've got a few other things kind of set up here.
Do you feel drowned out by Joe McGinnis and, you know, all the other books that have come out?
It's a little
out
bit of a sore topic.
Yeah. We were hoping the book would be out in August or September.
You would have just gone up against him, in other words.
I think it would have been good. I think it would have given two different perspectives that for people to see. We sold the book in February 2009, at that time. You know, Sarah was obviously way in the news. And I think part of what we were trying to do was using Sarah Palin, since there was lots of interest in her, as a way to tell the rest of the story.
Right.
That we wanted to tell, the story that mattered most to us. Obviously, now that she has kind of faded here, probably not as much interest nationally in the way that we would have hoped for, that the originally the way the book was sort of set up.
Yeah. Well, the part of oil certainly is holding up. I mean,
yeah. That part is, yeah. And in D.C., we had a good book party, and there were a lot of people from the American Petroleum Institute and former people who'd worked at ARCO or Exxon. And
don't forget Ralph Nader.
Yeah, Ralph Nader showed up, too.
Really?
I signed a book for Ralph
and
Nader.
And Ben Stein.
Did he read it? Did Nader read it?
I don't know if he'd read it yet. I think he had.
Well, you know, he did the foreword for another great book, Marketing of Alaska, and uh-huh. which is one of my favorite books, and I think has a lot of the same themes. You know, only difference, ran in the late 70s, not much has changed.
Right.
It was really amazing when I picked up that book and read the foreword and some of the first early chapters. I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, Groundhog Day. I mean, like I said, the date could have been changed and it was the same.
It's amazing.
Same exact story.
It's really eerie if you go back and look at the history of, like, say, Katala and all the fighting about that, or the fighting about the Morgan Guggenheim Syndicate and the Kennecott Mine and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just repeated over and over and over again, and it's always these over-the-top characters that you could not make up. I mean, you're not going to make up a Pequot.
Well, you know, and that was something that actually I started kind of getting really pretty depressed about halfway through writing this book when I realized that the same story was just being told over and over again in that way. I'm looking at the camera. And
I'm prompting the phone calls.
Oh, okay. All right. And so anyway, it just started getting depressing being a journalist up here and just writing the same story over and over again. But at least I have a standard nut graph now that I can use on all of my stories.
Talk of Alaska. Amanda Coyne, Tony Huffinger, our guests, authors of Crude Awakening. And Dave is on the phone from Cordova. Thanks for hanging on so long, Dave.
Oh, I enjoy listening to you guys. It's much fun as conversing with you on Facebook. It's that's a grand thing for all of us. But I guess the question that slightly off topic, but it shouldn't be, as one of the central characters of this whole thing, who had a pretty good skating coach apparently, is Ben Stevens getting off with all of the possibilities there of questionable actions on his part, and poof, he just sort of slid away into the sunset of history, and I just find that probably the most egregious thing about all of this, is that, you know, how, why, answers, are we ever going to get them? But I guess that's about it. I just don't think we should be left out of the discussion.
All right, Dave, thanks for the comment. We'll go ahead and make way for other callers at 1-800-478-8255 or a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Tony, no case on Ben Stevens. Wait a minute. We had direct testimony.
Well, what makes this an interesting narrative is that, the Justice Department, right, they did their thing. Then they got in trouble. And I think the will of the investigation sort of evaporated.
Being as how everybody was replaced, one committed suicide.
Yeah, I mean, it that's sort of the sad thing. I mean, if there really was truly misconduct on the part of prosecutors and perhaps the FBI, there might have been some important cases, including Ben Stevens, that should have been prosecuted. But that tainted everything of their own if they indeed committed, you know, some of these allegations of misconduct and cutting corners. And so that's really, you know, in one sense, it's great that the Justice Department shined the light on this and brought it out in the open and for our state to discuss what is too cozy for big business to be with our politicians. On the other hand, they didn't complete the task here. They screwed up themselves, and that's now tainted everything.
Yeah, I mean, I had, you know, yesterday the DNR deputy commissioner basically told the audience at the ACES debate, the oil tax debate yesterday at UAA campus, he was debating Les Guerra on whether or not we should lower oil taxes. He basically told the audience, listen, you know, what happened 5 years ago is history. Let's get over it. Let's forget it. Let's move on from that. And, you know, I don't think...
That's the problem. We've moved on too many times after these things.
I know. And I just really don't believe if the prosecutors had done everything that they needed to do and they complied with what, quote-unquote, Brady material, I don't think that we would be moving on so readily. I think that we would be, you know, still probably in the thick of it.
Well, as you know... Alaska's state government is sometimes lacking when it comes to ethical matters. It was federal prosecutors who dealt with the North Slope Borough scandal.
Mm-hmm.
It was and over again, the feds have stepped in and done things when Alaska hasn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we saw in this case that the feds, they're the ones that actually found a way to investigate a situation that many of us saw going on and didn't know what to do about.
I know. And that was another surprise in the book, too. I mean, I kind of knew it, but I didn't know it as starkly as I know it now, is how much reporters have been, focusing on this since oil was discovered. You know, how many great reporters have been focusing on this and wrote stories, and particularly want to give a shout out to Rich Maurer at the Anchorage Daily News, who's done a great job over the years and written stories upon story, and of course public radio too, over and over, and then and have it all come to naught until this particular time. And I understand now a little bit more why, when the FBI did come in, the general relief among Alaskan citizenry.
But at the same time, in the Alaskan residents here, I mean, because whether it's Rich or Steve or others who have been reporting on this for decades, there was not a reaction. There was not a call to do something about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it became, when I moved here, when I worked at the, in the Anchorage Daily News newsroom and whatnot, I mean, it was just sort of given. Well, Vehicle, kind of runs things and,
yeah.
Can't do much about it, whatever, I mean, that kind of just allowing things to happen like that causes problems, and it's unfortunate the Justice Department was not able to run a clean investigation.
Well, yeah, and then there's the entire business of rewriting the American Fisheries Act behind closed doors entirely,
yes.
Sticking it on as a rider, setting up a new salmon marketing outfit,
mm-hmm.
That your son and your former top aide
Trevor
end
McCabe.
Up running,
and we never got
no charges on that.
No charges, and it would have been interesting just to see some of that end up in a hearing, in a court case. I mean, unfortunately,
yeah.
We don't even get that at this point to really know what was going on there or not. And
But although I would say, too, there's nothing to keep the state from kind of delving into some of this and investigating it on their own. Apparently, they're...
But can we do that with an attorney general appointed by our governor? I don't know.
Hmm. Well, coming from a state where the attorney general runs for office, there's not a lot to recommend that one either.
No, I know that.
It's a hard, and that's, I guess, why you do have the Justice Department to be able to come in and look at these things. But,
Well, they're limited by federal statute, too.
Yeah.
So, they got to go with that. Now, Honest Services has been
out
the window, and nobody, I don't see any move to do anything about that. So, and this is the main prosecution tool for federal prosecutors, mm-hmm. on corruption, and suddenly it's gone, thrown out by the Roberts Court. It's not even discussed.
Right. It was the one charge they could always kind of count on. Yeah, absolutely.
It's not even discussed.
Yeah.
So there we are. I don't see much you can do about it.
And so it goes on.
Set up a tent in Wall Street. Let's talk to Dirk in Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dirk.
Yeah, there seemed to be some indication or implication there that this was atypical behavior for the Justice Department in terms of the cleanliness of the investigation involving Ted Stevens and others. I think if you look at historical cases involving the Justice Department, and I'm no Aryan separatist, but look at Randy Weaver's case. I'm not a Black Panther. Look at Geronimo Pratt's case. Look at Leonard Peltier's case. Look at some of the local cannabis cultivation cases the feds handled in the state of Alaska. The game playing with disclosure and other aspects of federal prosecution is rampant. The exceptional treatment that Ted Stevens received was the fact that they vacated his conviction. None of those other people who suffered similar treatment received that benefit. As far as the state handling things, Ray Metcalf, on his own dime, years before any of this became public, had handed out evidence packets to the entirety of the legislature, the Alaska state troopers, the attorney general, and others, few of whom even responded to the evidence packets. And in one case or more, several cases, I guess, the attorney general wrote him back telling him that there was no evidence of any wrongdoing.
Yeah,
so, you know, the state passively invited federal intervention, and the feds handled it the way they typically handle things, which is dirty pool.
You know,
it cost us a lot of progress.
And I would even say, I mean, I remember clearly we had a story that we wrote back in 2004 where we talked about the vehicle contributions that Ben Stevens got. And Ray Metcalf had been a source and helped talking about things and whatnot and really got us thinking about that. We wrote a story.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean, people elect these lawmakers. They allowed those kind of things to happen. And that's you know, Alaskans have some of this on their own.
There was a four-year selective amnesia that goes on perpetually in this country, which has some of the same schmoes and schmoozers reelected to offices, which of all the people I can think of are the least deserving of those positions.
Well, there's an attitude I've got mine in Alaska, you know, quite a bit. I mean, probably in some ways more. And I think, and I would attribute that to oil. But I do want to talk about just a little bit about the point that you make that this is kind of something that federal prosecutors do. I mean, Tony's going to be looking at me. You know, he's giving me the dirty eye because this has kind of been my.
What are we getting into now?
This is kind of my bugaboo, frankly. I mean, there's a reason why 99% of federal cases get settled right outside of trial. I mean, the federal government, particularly with disclosure and laws, are just they really have the power on their side, and you have the full force of the federal government coming down to prosecute somebody, and they have unlimited money to do so. You know, it can get kind of scary, and
that's why Ted Stevens was able to fight back.
Yeah.
And whereas some of the other examples he gave, I mean, people don't have the money to defend themselves.
Well, remember the machinery of the FBI and them would bring in there to the courtroom and those.
It's amazing.
Trials,
I know.
All that high tech.
And imagine, this is what I keep on hearing over and over from defense lawyers, which I've heard for years, is they've been screaming about this kind of behavior, and particularly with drug laws, with drug cases. They've been, screaming about this. And my understanding is that a lot of these, and particularly, many of these prosecutors were raised in an atmosphere where just kind of like anything goes, you just got to get the bad guys in prison. And they're using that now, that kind of attitude towards politicians. And it just didn't work this time.
Mm. There was a ramp up within the FBI over, it started kind of around 2003-2004, where they really took on public corruption around the country. And so there were a lot, everything from your local sheriff all the way up to governors. I mean, there was a mandate to go out and dig up cases on public corruption.
And it was very interesting, especially because it was under Bush. And
that's right.
This was the idea of public integrity is going to cut its own path here. And it worked for a while, but it ain't working anymore. Dirk, I want to thank you for fulminating out of Fairbanks. That was fantastic.
Yeah, yes. Thanks, Dirk.
Thank you.
All right. It's Talk of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. And by BuzzBiz Studios, a full-spectrum media production studio with marketing services. BuzzBiz Studios help Alaskan businesses be seen and be heard in all advertising media. Additional information at BuzzBiz.biz.
It's Talk of Alaska, the subject, Crude Awakening. Authors Amanda Coyne and Tony Hopfinger with us. And you guys, married couples that work together have either, like, it's sickly sweet or else they fight all the time. you're the kind of fight a lot.
Right. You kind of.
I want to know
you
if
caught that, huh?
Yeah, I want. I recognize it. It's personal with me. I want to know whether you, Tony, fought having the handcuff issue being put in this book, whether you didn't want it in, because I have seen you be very reluctant to ever stand in the spotlight over that. You say, this is just happened to me. I'm just Joe Schmo reporter, and I shouldn't be singled out for this.
Well, we put it in third person as a journalist, and then the editor changed it. So I don't know. I mean, it's at this point, it is what it is. I just didn't want, you know, especially back last fall and earlier this year, I didn't want to take away from Alaska Dispatch's work, and that was the risk. I guess it's fine, the book, and it's only about two sentences.
It was Joe Miller. Right.
But it was part of the Joe Miller story that needed to be told, because the story there is an erosion of credibility to where, the Alaska electorate kind of ends up in the situation, oh, my God.
Yeah.
We could really be doing something we don't want to do here.
Yeah.
So it was interesting, and that issue of the Joe Miller security forces putting the cuffs on you sort of was a crystallization of that. And often this will happen.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's sometimes you can't avoid having yourself in there, related to your story or whatnot. I mean, the interesting thing about the guy who handcuffed me, he's a government witness himself.
That's a whole other book now.
Yeah, right. Jill Burke at Alaska Dispatch, our investigative reporters, was spending a lot of time with that. And there's another case that's sort of potentially imploding right now.
Yes, it has kind of shrunk a bit, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. You know, the Fed, we'll have to
that's
see what
the militia case in Fairbanks.
Right.
We'll have to see what the Feds do with the weapons charges, but the state is sort of, backing out of it a bit now, so.
Right. Well, I got a comment here from Crystal who says, hey, you just said on air something like, if you drain Alaska's oil from the history, then most of Alaska history drains away too. Well, Alaska has a much longer and richer history than just the last 50 plus years of statehood. And big oil, particularly with our native people who've been here from time immemorial, or at least 10,000 years from what scientists have been able to figure out so far. I know this comment wasn't really meant to minimize or trivialize Alaska Native history, but please be careful in the way you talk about Alaska and its history, and remember to be more inclusive and respectful to Alaska Native history.
That's
point
true, and I should probably taken. Point take it, and there's another question up there, but I should have probably also add that, you know, we shouldn't have let that comet go quite like it did, because my grandparents moved up here in 1939.
Wow.
Way before oil, so.
Part of another federal project.
Yeah.
Well, let's see, I can't quite understand a phrase there. He said, why did the author say Democrat lawmaker instead of Democratic lawmaker? That's a Rush Limbaughism.
Okay, whatever.
I don't know. I don't know. I didn't catch that one. Yes, and here's again from Tom from Talkeetna. Please ask Amanda or Tony if it's proper to say Democrat Center or Democratic Center. Okay, go ahead.
I say Democratic Center, but I think that both. Actually, I've looked both of these things up, and I think that they're both okay. Huh. I don't know. What do you think, Steve?
I was totally unaware of any of this.
I'm not sure who said it. Yeah, but we apologize.
Sometimes when sometimes not getting Fox TV, I just all this stuff just leaves me behind. So have you got good distribution on Crude Awakening?
There's about 6,000 copies for the first run.
Uh-huh.
And it should be in bookstores all over. And you can get it on Amazon, or better yet, you could buy it up there in Palmer at Fireside Books and buy it online there as well. You don't have to actually go to the bookstore.
That's kind of a
support
nice,
your independent bookstores.
Nice way to sell books.
Yes.
Yeah, it really
actually
is.
go through the actual local person that's trying to run a bookstore.
That's
these
important
days.
To know. I mean, any of these independent bookstores, you can order them online as well. You don't have to go through Amazon.
Yeah. So would you like to be able to muster a press tour? I know publishers hardly ever pay for these things anymore.
Well, if you want to pay for it. we're doing what we can on our own dime. There's not a lot of resources.
No, not at Nation Books.
No, no, and there's... They're a small publisher, but they did help us in Seattle, and our publisher at Alaska Dispatch, Alice Rogoff, threw an excellent book release party in Washington, D.C. about a week and a half ago, and we'll just kind of be running around the state, I guess, for the next couple months.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
as you can do it.
As we can do it with our day job.
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, there is, yeah, watching the store, isn't there?
Yeah, that was probably the biggest challenge of putting
I'll
the
bet.
Book.
And maybe the biggest source of tension between us as a married couple, because we both own, you know, equal parts of the Dispatch, and we both, you know, we're writing this book, and
Amanda,
both have different, you know, a little bit of a different writing style.
Amanda was the lead writer on the book, and she took off about a year, year and a half. She didn't work at Dispatch, and then I was working there, and then I would help, you know, her here and there on the book. You know, I can't say enough to the crew at Alaska Dispatch for putting up with all this while we were doing that book.
I mean,
other people have to pick up slack, and those guys have been awesome at doing it. And I'm very, very, very happy with how things have turned out.
So how close is this book to the book that you pitched?
It's almost chapter for chapter the proposal we put together.
Isn't
there's
that
a couple,
something?
I mean, except for the February 2009, right? So Senator Stevens hadn't died yet and Joe Miller hadn't happened and there wasn't a massive write-in campaign.
Right.
Campaign for Lisa Marzano. There were those things, but, and Sarah hadn't quit yet either.
Right.
So barring the last, I guess, two chapters, the rest of it is almost pretty much the proposal.
Yeah, and you guys, you know, went to Strohmeyer to get some of that stuff, the Alaska.
Tony put together, let me just be clear about this. Tony put together the proposal. He went away. We sent him away for a few weeks.
Passed the buck.
He came back with this massive, like, 50-page proposal and was kind of like, whoa, you know, there's a lot of information here that I don't know about. But, yeah, we relied on Strohmeyer, you know, Dermot Cole, Klaus Nasky, Jack Roderick with Crude Dreams, which is an amazing, there's a little known book called Discovery at Prudhoe Bay by John, a geologist by John Sweet in Denver. That was amazing. Stephen Haycox's work. I mean, we can go on and on. I hope I'm not missing somebody
else.
Well,
that's good. I'm glad you tipped the hat. Let's get a call in here from Joanne and, you know, Cleet. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Tony and Amanda.
Yeah, good morning. It's Una LaCleet.
Okay.
Anyway, the point I have two questions. One of them is what was the writers, how good or poor or however, how would they rate their relationship with the Anchorage Daily News and acquiring information from that newspaper? And then my next question is, was the writing, voting of Murkowski included in the book? And I'll just go ahead and listen.
Okay, I think that, do you want to address question number one?
I think that, I mean, as far as Anchorage Daily News, and we mentioned this in the book, look, they wrote much of the first draft of history of this state, and we very much, I was amazed at, just looking back at the clips, you know, there are footnotes in there, and anything that we cited in the narrative, we tried to give credit to, tried very religiously to identify the things that we picked.
20 seconds.
Okay, so.
But then they wouldn't let us in their archives either.
No,
so.
No, but that's fine. As far as, what was the other question?
How much in depth do you cover the writing campaign?
It's in the epilogue, so not a whole heck of a lot. By that point, we were past our deadline.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Amanda Coyne, Tony Hoffinger.
Thank you very much.
The book is Crude Awakening, Money, Mavericks, and Mayhem in Alaska. I hope the studio cam can pick this up here. It's been a pleasure having
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank
Appreciate
you so much.
It.
Thank you to Josh Edge and Dave Waldron in the tech department. And we'll be back again next week. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.